Hey guys, welcome to episode 10 of the To Be Fit podcast. Today I am delighted to be joined all the way from America, Texas, with Jeff Ash. And I believe Jeff has now become my favourite member of the Mac Nutrition students. He's kind of like up there with Martin, of people that I like on the course. So Jeff, welcome to the podcast.
Wow, thanks for that nice introduction.
Well, thank you for joining me.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
What time is it over in Texas, Jeff, just so people...
10 a.m.
10 a.m., so it's not too bad. It's 4 p.m. here. So, Jeff, just so the listeners can get to know you a little bit, would you like to introduce yourself, please?
Yeah, sure. As you said, my name's Jeff. I live in the Dallas, Texas area. And I've been here for several years. I grew up in New Mexico, Albuquerque specifically. So I grew up right near mountains and in a, lots of outdoor activities, that kind of thing. I've been into rock climbing over the years and played baseball, lots of different activities like that, competitive karate, just a variety of different physical pursuits. And then, of course, I've had my stretches where my health was not particularly great. My eating was bad. And so gone through different phases like that. And now I just enjoy working out and kind of doing bodybuilding type stuff. Oh. But
brilliant. I mean, so generally ask all the people how the kind of what led them to the path to MNU. Do you mind telling us a little bit about that, please?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, when I was 19 or so, I got interested in physical therapy. So I got certified as a physical therapy technician and really enjoyed it. But then I kind of got away from that and ended up going into software engineering, which was something I'd been doing since I was a kid. And that's what I've been doing the last 20 years. And so, but over the course of that time, really more since probably... Well, when I got doing karate in my early 30s, I started thinking a lot more about my health. And I've always been interested in the health aspects and that kind of thing. But I think a lot of what has driven me to really pursue this area has just been a number of things that have happened over the course of my life. First and foremost, well, I'd say there's probably three different people who have really influenced my path in this direction. The first one being my father, who was a pastor of a small church in the roughest neighborhood, highest crime area in Albuquerque, New Mexico. It's nicknamed the War Zone, so that kind of gives you an idea what people think of that area. I lived there for 20 years, and we lived next door to the church. And so often people would show up at our house at all hours of the night, throughout the day, middle of the night, needing help. Homeless people would show up, and my dad would just take them down to the homeless shelter. He never hesitated to help people, treated everybody with kindness, respect. Didn't matter if they had money, if they were homeless and didn't know him. He just basically assumed everybody was going to be fine and that he'd help them out. We had a schizophrenic man lived across the street. He'd come over every day. My dad would go out and talk with him, visit with him. Very odd person, but my dad didn't just treated him like with respect as every human is deserving of. He'd make him a sandwich, give him a Coke, and they'd sit and visit. And so this was kind of the model that I grew up with in seeing that. And so it's really shaped me as a person in the way kind of my attitudes in serving people and always looking out for the best in people, trying to bring out the best in people. Also just helping people in general. And so that's kind of the first person I'd say who kind of shaped me as a person. And then we have my first wife, who has since passed away. She struggled with her weight her whole life. We were married for 15 years before she passed away, probably about 13 years into it. So it was back in 2008, she got diagnosed with breast cancer. Prior to that, her weight was always an issue, but she really never could really do much to get it under control. She tried curves a time or two and that kind of thing, but nothing really stuck. So with the breast cancer was kind of a real wake-up call for her. And so really she made a 180 turn at that point, really started working on her health and getting interested in it again. And, you know, as a spouse, it's hard to walk that line of encouraging your wife to that she needs to lose weight without also giving her the impression that you think she's fat and needs to lose weight, you know, that kind of a...
Yeah, that's a toughie, isn't it?
Yeah, so when she came to the decision for herself, that really made it possible for me to then help her. So I was able to help her over the next 18 months to lose 140 pounds through diet changes and exercise and consistency in that way. But then this was in 2010, she had a tumor in her chest that we didn't know about and ended up passing away from that. And so that was kind of a defining moment, I guess, for me. So I was able to see throughout the course of the time that we were married what obesity does to a person mentally, physically, emotionally. You know, we were very close in the way we in talking about different things. And later on, she kind of explained some of the different things that had shaped her views of food and herself and her body image over the years. You know, like when she was a preteen, her dad said, if you lose X amount of pounds, I'll buy you a new wardrobe. You know, just things that are horrible to say to a girl, you know, well-meaning. He meant well by it, but really cement some negative attitudes and views inside that person. So anyway, after she passed away, then I worked through issues of depression and really gained a new appreciation for people who are struggling with emotional issues, really wrapping my head around the emotional issues that she had struggled with, being overweight her whole life and all of that. And so that really shaped a lot. And then in 2012, I met my wife now, and you know, wonderful woman. She's very giving, very serving, very loving, encouraging and compassionate toward others and this kind of thing. So I'm able to be around that all the time. Well, she has lupus. She has systemic and discoid also. And about a month after we got married, she started having these what they call thunderclap headaches, which really the name describes it. It's like you got hit with a bolt of lightning in your head, and then blood would come out her nose and her ears and this kind of thing. So, you know, your first impression is what? Brain cancer.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah. But it turned out that she has something called idiopathic intracranial hypertension, or sometimes it's called pseudotumor cerebri. And basically what it is it's a lifelong condition. You know, once you have it, you're pretty much going to have it. You have too much spinal fluid pressure inside your brain. So hers runs anywhere from 2 times up to 5 times the amount of spinal fluid pressure in her brain. So you can imagine the kind of pain that would cause if somebody were, you know, to pump 5 times the amount of spinal fluid that you need inside your brain, the pressure that would cause. And she's had eye surgeries to prevent going blind from it. And she has blackouts and numerous visits to the ER. Sometimes we've been over 20 times in the course of a year. And so she has that, two benign brain tumors, and then fibromyalgia. So what that's kind of brings me to another one. You know, she's struggled periodically with weight also as a result of these chronic issues. And so now, I guess, long story short, all of these different events have really helped me to develop a real love for people, a love for helping people, an appreciation, and as much understanding as possible for somebody who hasn't actually gone through those things themselves, but an appreciation for people struggling with obesity and other weight-related issues, as well as chronic health conditions and problems, and kind of what all the different things that surround that and all the different facets that are involved in that and the different areas of your life that are impacted by that. And so so I guess that's kind of what's been driving me to really begin to help people at a more professional level as far as nutrition coaching training also, because I'm certified as a personal trainer also. And so when I came across MNU, that kind of answers your question in a very long way. When I came across MNU in another group, I looked at it and I thought, wow, this is exactly what I would love to do, to kind of take all of this stuff that, over the few years I've been gradually helping more people in sort of an informal way, coaching people here and there periodically through other fitness groups and this kind of thing, but really taking it to the next level and doing it in a more structured, professional manner. And so MNU was kind of the exactly what I was looking for. When I looked over that syllabus, I thought, man, this is going to take me exactly where I need to go. The evidence-based thing really rings, really warms my heart, because I'm very critical as far as the way I'm thinking as a software engineer. That's my job. And so I like facts, I like evidence. But then I think in combination with that, my experiences over the years, it's really going to help me to take the facts and apply it to each individual person, and then be able to come up with strategies at the individual level to help them achieve their goals. And so,
I mean, wow.
So that's kind of where I'm coming.
Yeah, I mean, where do we go from there, really? firstly, sorry about, the loss of your wife. I mean, but, this is the impression that I got, and probably most people do get from you within the kind of mentoring lab and on the course, is, Jeff's just a really nice, helpful guy, and I see all the kind of comment threads with, a little bit of input from Jeff, and that's why I'm really excited kind of having you on here and kind of hearing your backstory. And like you say, you've got a hell of a lot of empathy out there for just humankind, which I think is a rare thing, and such an important quality as a good coach isn't necessarily how much knowledge you have, but, how warming you are to clients. And I think it's absolutely brilliant. That kind of background it got is just going to be massively influential in the people that I think should already be looking at you thinking, oh God, this guy's just really good.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that it's very important to me to, one, be able to help people. I mean, I think that's what that's just it's something that I think as a result of the kind of upbringing that I had with such a tight, close, loving father and mother, and that family situation there, the experiences that I've been through, the fact that I've managed to maintain my health. I mean, I haven't been sick literally in 10 years. I mean, I never get sick. The worst issues I've had are just very minor little things, sore back here and there, that kind of thing. So for me, it's almost like I feel like it's my duty to share the experiences that I've been through, to help people that may be struggling with those same things, and to help them in any way that I can with the experiences that I've been through. And then since I love learning so much, I suck up this stuff, the nutrition stuff, and I love the research parts of it. I love learning how to interact with people. I'm even going to be looking at picking up, James Clear has this book, Atomic Habits, and learning more about habit formation and just everything that's going to help in those areas. And I think it's just kind of, since I have these abilities, I have my health, I have these experiences, I feel like it's my duty to really share as much as I can with people. I mean, I've learned so much from so many other people, like Martin and Spencer Nadolski, Danny Lennon, the people he has on his podcast, and now from people like yourself and others in the lab. I'm just learning so much, and I think it's kind of my duty as to pass that on to people and share that.
And I think this is kind of another reason why I want to do the podcast, is because I really like talking to other coaches who are essentially in the same boat. We all want to help people.
Mm-hmm. And you can tell. That's something I've really noticed with your podcast, is the people you've had on, they just, my attitude here is not unique to the people in MNU, and it's not unique to the people you've had on. They've all expressed very much this innate desire to serve people and help people and bring the best out in people. So
again, which I think is just the most important quality as a coach, is accepting you don't know everything and you're happy to to look into, delve into different areas. You mentioned James Clear's book. I just finished it last week, and it's brilliant, you know, and it's kind of like the course that there's no shocks or surprises. There's no hacks. There's no like silver bullets. It's just kind of simple things done well, you know? So I think get it. Black Friday. It might be on sale. That was yesterday kicking off. But I mean, you mentioned training wise, you're into like sort of a bit of bodybuilding here and there.
I guess that's kind of where my weightlifting influence came from. I started off getting, you know, when I was in high school, in my later years in high school, early adult years, I was heavily into rock climbing. I was all about that. That's probably where my first real taste of structured training and thinking about nutrition, even though my nutrition was way off base. It was basically low fat, so I tried to eat as little fat as possible, which was silly because that's just not the way to do it. But, you know, that was kind of the first time where I was consciously thinking of things. You know, we climbed 7 days a week and trained very hard. And I reached a pretty high level with that, did some competing and that kind of thing. Got away from that after I got married. And then did some karate because my health my health markers were a bit off because I'd been letting myself slide for a while, and got into that, did some competing. I've always been very competitive. And then after my wife passed away, really it was after I got married back in 2012, I did one of those bodybuilding.com transformation challenges. I thought, oh, okay, this is interesting, because I had started getting back into kind of doing more of a bodybuilding type thing and been following that, did that transformation challenge. And I guess that kind of really got me fired up, even though it was probably a very wrong approach to be taking. I got a lot of misinformation from people on the threads, you know, the whole, just all the bro science. Pretty much every stereotypical bro science thing out there I heard and believed and promoted myself.
Yeah, I think we've all been there. And I'd imagine the landscape of nutritional recommendations has shifted massively across your time and experience. Karate, what are you, a certain belt?
The dojo I trained at did not just hand out belts. It took you a long time. So I was ready to test for my brown belt when my wife passed away. And I just never, at that time, my brain was not working right. I ended up moving about 30 miles away from where the dojo was and just kind of stopped training. So I never tested for it. But I trained for probably 4 years, I guess. And from the time I started training, I loved the idea of competing. So I competed and did that kind of thing. And so every time I get into something, I tend to get really focused on it. And because I just really enjoy that whole aspect of training, I guess. I think it just sucks me in every time. You know, when I started climbing, got sucked in and heavily training karate, did the same thing. Then when I got kind of interested in bodybuilding, kind of sucked me in also. And so now I do more of a bodybuilding approach, but then I throw in a little powerlifting type stuff too. I've done some powerlifting cycles, and then I'm actually getting back into rock climbing now. So now I'm back in thinking, well, I don't know if I want to keep focusing on hypertrophy. Yeah. If I want to kind of optimize strength to weight ratio. So,
and to be fair, I think this kind of links well with the course. You know that there's diversity there. There isn't kind of a one size fits all model with nutrition, and there shouldn't be with training. It's kind of like, do what you like sort of scenario. Exactly. Everybody's so keen to fit into a box these days, whereas you're the karate, bodybuilding, rock climbing Jeff.
Yeah. And I just enjoy different kinds of training. So
yeah, I mean, our first kind of introduction onto the MNU course was like, what are your biases, you know? So like, what were your biases? Is there any that, you know, jump out at you that you think, oh, Jeff, what an idiot?
Well, I would definitely say my biggest bias was in the area of tracking macros.
I think everybody pretty much said that. Yeah.
I know a lot of us were in that same boat, and I think that was in my mind. It was, well, maybe it doesn't work for everybody. It's the best way to do it. Everybody should be doing it if they're smart. You know, that kind of a bias where I might not say that out loud, but that's, if I'm honest, that's kind of what was going on through my head. And part of it was just that it worked really well for me. I mean, when I track, I can literally manipulate my weight almost exactly to the pound over a given period of time just by sticking to my plan, because I've got so much data tracked that I can do that. But I also know that it just doesn't work for everybody. My late wife, she didn't track macros when she lost 140 pounds. In fact, a lot of the things that she did that we came up with to help her stick to a calorie deficit were not ideal ways of doing nutrition. You know, she did the 100 calorie snack pack type things, which, you know, you typically don't advise that, but for her it worked. And for her, just focusing on not eating too much was a good thing. You know, another thing we did that was, you know, from a food relationship standpoint that was just horrible when you think about it, is that she didn't go in the kitchen much at all. I did all the food preparations. I got food for her, almost spoon fed her in a sense, not exactly, but you know, that kind of idea, because she knew that the more she was around it and in the kitchen, the harder it would be for her. So that got better over time, but at first that was kind of what she needed to stick to the most important thing, which at the time, the most important thing for her was not fix her relationship with food. It was, okay, you know what? You seriously need to lose some weight and start getting on the right track. And then over time, we can start working on these other areas. And so as time went on, she started working on that, those different areas with food relationship and choosing better food selections and those kinds of things. So I guess I'm not sure where I was going with that, but
well, I think a good point to pull from that is the diet that kind of gets the weight off doesn't necessarily have to look like the diet that keeps the weight off.
Exactly. There you go.
You know, yeah. So I saved you there, Jeff. Yeah.
My bias was on the tracking, but I guess in seeing that and then talking with more people in the MNU lab that have worked with a lot of clients in the professional, more professional sense, and just as I've learned more about it, it's been really cool to see there's so many different ways to approach that. And so that's kind of washed out that bias quite a bit. And
I think the majority of us within that group love tracking because we are all pretty much geeks, you know, and like we love that data and we want that kind of feedback that, hey, if I need to change something, I'd want to know what I'm changing.
Right.
You know, so my with tracking previously to me, it'd be like, you know, if somebody needs a change to the diet, and I'm kind of like, well, what have I got to work with? You know, so like I'm a huge fan of journaling, and I tell people initially not even to bother looking at the numbers and things like that, because I think just purely the either writing it down or logging it in your phone, and they tend to, I mean, get a little bit curious anyway and start looking at the numbers themselves. So it's kind of like, I think I mentioned to you, planting the seed. You're kind of like,
right. Yeah. I love that.
You know, so they kind of like start tracking on the phones because it's easier, more convenient. They've always got them. And then they start asking questions like, oh, how many calories should I be doing? And like your late wife, it's a decision that they come to, even mm-hmm. though that, you know, that you may have wanted them to do that, so you just plant these seeds about, and they generally think they came to the decision themselves. I hope none of my clients are listening right now. They're probably like, wait a minute, this son of a bitch.
Yeah.
he got me.
He tricked me.
Yeah, the bastard.
Yeah.
But yeah, like you say, most people, I think, initial go-to was tracking. And I think identifying our biases is really an important thing, because there's going to be many people that are outside of them. So being able to critically think and, you know, understand that there's many ways to skin a cat.
Yeah. I mean, I had biases too with training style and everything too. And it's kind of funny because it really shows the less you know, the more you think you know, it seems like. So as I've learned more and more, I actually realize how little I truly know or knew at the time. And I think that's actually a good place to be, is that you realize is hitting this place where, you know, there's so much more to learn than what I already know. But when you first start learning it early on, you have this idea that, oh man, you learn a couple things, you learn macros, and it's like, oh, I have this whole thing figured out. I know how to train. I know the best way to train. I know the best way to eat, and I know the best way to tell it. I'm going to tell everybody the same thing. So
it's like that guy who does a competition, a bodybuilding competition, and all the next day they're a prep coach.
Yeah, exactly.
It's it's how the industry kind of goes, isn't it? And like training wise, there's just so much diversity out there. I mean, I think in my younger days there was a case where I knew nothing, but I was cocky as hell and thought I knew everything. Then I got into kind of learning and then realized I knew fuck all. So I was very I was very much overwhelmed with how much I didn't know and how much I needed. Right. I thought I needed to know. And which is a good thing about this course, because it's very like practical. Whereas you know, I just thought, oh God, I need to memorize all of this. Like I need to, and like, it was just so overwhelming. But now I'm in a position of like, oh, actually, you know, and I think MNU's helped me with that as well, to go, listen, just because some people do know how to read research papers back to back, it doesn't make you any less of a person or a coach, you know. And I think that's massively important for people to hear that, you know, play to your strengths. You don't have to be the best at everything. And like, you
well,
know,
I know that was.
Sorry, go ahead. Oh. Sorry, Jeff.
Oh, no, you go ahead. Sorry, I just.
Well, that's the thing I was going to say about you. You know, like, Jeff, you're the person I'll message if, like, there's maybe a research paper thing that I'm not reading right and things like that, because you seem bang into them as well.
Yeah, I mean, I enjoy them. And one of the things, you know, just going back to what you were saying with the course, one of the things I really like is that Martin and the other lecturers are always emphasizing that, okay, don't get overwhelmed by this, because you don't really need this right here. You don't have to understand this in depth to work with clients. We want you to understand the processes under the covers, get an understanding of generally what's going on, but ultimately these are the other things that you need to focus on when working with clients. And I know for me, it's really helped to kind of, you know, when I came into it, I thought, I'm going to have to learn so much here, just in case somebody brings up an argument, I better be able to give them an answer. I better be able to show them a research paper or this and that. And then I'm starting to really learn that, you know, most people don't care about that stuff. Most people just want to have simple tools to help them reach their goals and eat better and work, exercise better and those kinds of things.
I mean, that's the thing, like, you know, talking about arguing online and debating and things like that, I think it's something that I just don't really entertain. Not for the fact that I'm scared I'm lose, I just think, you know, it sounds a bit harsh, but you're never going to convince somebody with a bias who is a zealot or whatever like that. And it's just kind of, is it worth the energy? And I think people assume they're going to lose face with these people, and it's just a case of like, I literally can't be asked to like look up these studies and so on and so forth, and like you know, put them across there. So I tend to like kind of avoid them at the same state, in the same position as, like, you know, I don't want to look like an idiot myself. People are scared to put information possibly out there, like put that infographic or write that status in case somebody calls them out, I assume.
Right.
How would you, have you dealt with anything like that, or how would you be dealing with it? I think professionally would be the first thing.
Well, and I think, you know, for me, I'm very passive person for the most part. I tend to see the best in everybody. I tend to avoid confrontation, which I think is a good quality, but it's also something that, like, that part I don't have to think about. That's sort of my natural reaction. The part that I do think that I'm going to have to work on as a coach is being a little more confrontational with some people, because there are some people who need to be told you're being an idiot. Yeah. You know, you're okay. You know, quit BSing me. Just stop it. Don't lie to my face. I know what's going on here. You know, so there's going to be times where that's probably going to need to be done with certain people. And so those are things I'm going to have to be aware of. But in these, you know, in, as far as confrontations online, so far I haven't really had anybody do that to a significant degree. I've had a few discussions with some other people on other threads, but most of them were not very knowledgeable anyway. And so just putting up a few facts and studies basically shut them up because they didn't have the background. But you know, if I had somebody, you know, debating somebody who had a very strong background would be difficult. And so that's just not something I'm really interested in. I'm not particularly good at it, and I'm just trying to put out the best information I can and hope that I don't get called out too much too often.
I think a lot of the stuff, the evidence-based stuff, is very thought-provoking amongst like the general population, because you know they've been led to believe this is factual when in actual fact it's it's bullshit, really. A lot of the stuff that is out there, unfortunately. And I think it's more important that we continually fight the good fight and, you know, provide these infographics, these statuses, these podcasts, videos, so on and so forth. And, you know, you became Instagram famous and you're looking for your blue tick when Martin reposted. But, like, you know, I'll say this now, like, literally follow the hashtag Mac Nutrition Uni, and you're going to like be filtered with all of these kind of evidence-based infographics posts and all of these kind of good things. Whereas, you know, Kim Kardashian selling the latest like skinny coffee or whatever is what the majority of the kind of general population are consuming. And it's a bit sad.
Well, you know, one of the things I try and do is I do try and look at, you know, I follow a number of people who I don't agree with them at all. You know, I know they're not evidence-based, but they are successful in getting their message across. And so I do follow some different people for that reason, to kind of, if there's anything that I can pull from that to help get my message across better without compromising, then I'd like to do that. So I'm careful about that and who I follow, but I do try and get some ideas from things like that, because I do want to try and get my message across as best as possible.
You know, they're doing something right if they've got the reach they've got.
Right. Yeah, whether it's just in the way they're presenting it or the way they're simplifying things, because being an engineer, I can way overcomplicate things. I can use all the correct terminology, but most people don't understand it. I can give too much data, too much information sometimes, and overwhelm. So that's actually something that I practice a lot with our posts and going through MNU and stuff, is really simplifying it down, watching other people like yourself, like Danny Boy,
you know. Danny Boy.
And they are. He's just these different ways of presenting the information in a simple way to communicate the point as best as possible. So learning a lot.
So professionally right now, you're a software engineer.
Yes.
So what's the big picture looking like, Jeff? What we're thinking long term as far as career is concerned? Are you looking to transition or start like just taking on close friends and family? What's the plan, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I actually enjoy my job, so that's a good thing. I'm not desperate to get out of it or anything like that. I've been there 20 years. I'm well established there. I enjoy it. It's kind of second nature now. I just kind of go in and do my thing. I do work from home, which helps a lot because it does free me up from any kind of additional time commuting, those kinds of things. And so also my kids are grown, so I don't have the kid family stuff to be involved in. And And then my wife is medically retired, and so she's home all the time too, so I don't have to set aside time in the evening just for spending time with my wife. So I have a lot of, I guess I have a lot more free time than most people would working in a job like I do. And so since I love nutrition so much and love the coaching aspect of it, basically what I'm looking to do is this will be a kind of a side business that will be a separate, kind of, I'll take on as much as I can handle. Have to be very conscious not to take on too much. But that will be where it starts, and then from there we'll just see where it goes.
Yeah, your problem is, Jeff, you're too much of a nice guy, and you want to help everyone, and that's going to happen. You're gonna struggle denying helping somebody, which essentially is everybody who wants to, you know, who comes along your path that, you know, they want some form of help.
Yeah, yeah, and I'm well aware of my tendency to overcommit. And spend way too much time. And usually what it means is I just end up sleeping way too little on my side. And so I have to make sure that I don't do that. But the good thing is I'm very aware of it. And my wife is also very aware of my tendency to do that. And she's already said, you know, we've got to set some boundaries here and this kind of thing, which is good to have that other person there to kind of keep me reined in.
Yeah, I think you sound like me. You get a bit carried away with yourself and need reined in. I think I've done that a lot over the past few years, but that's from a bodybuilder, competitive bodybuilder. So, you know, you have to be a bit obsessive and extreme to do that sort of shit.
Yeah.
Let's talk about this kind of week's Mac Nutrition University sort of module. This one's quite a good one. We can probably talk about this one a little bit more than I have in the past, because I mentioned before the podcast, I mean, what am I going to talk about? The digestive and endocrine system, you know?
Yeah.
And what practical things can people take away from my little knowledge of that still? Whereas, like, right, you know, we're bodybuilders, we know protein. So this week was all about protein. You kick us off, Jeff. What kind of key things did you kind of take away from this week?
Yeah, well, there was the typical thing. I think probably both of us, I mean, I know you certainly did, and I did, coming into the course, we knew kind of what the protein range recommendations were for, especially for the bodybuilding and those who are very physically active. And so, you know, kind of the Gen Pop recommendation of 1.2 to 1.6 kilograms per pound of body weight a day, and the
seems low to us.
Yeah, I know. Then you got your 1.8 to 2.7 for your strength athletes, and the interesting one that popped out to me was, since I've never really got into endurance sports, that the recommendation is just a hair more than maybe Gen Pop, so the 1.2 to 1.7. So that was good for me to know. And kind of along that lines, one of the things that jumped out at me that was kind of interesting was that the protein can be very helpful for endurance athletes in improving the mitochondria, which is kind of that powerhouse of energy. And so that was kind of an interesting thing for me to know. I didn't really dig deep into that, but that was interesting where it emphasized that was an important aspect of protein for endurance athletes, because you don't necessarily think of that for somebody who's just running, that they need to make sure their protein is really,
yeah,
really taken.
And I think that's even the slightly myth around protein, that you only need to take it when you are actually like physically active, you know, and in particular doing more strength oriented stuff. So that was something that was really good for me, seeing that, hey, endurance athletes, they need it. But another thing I'll even tell the average Jane or Joe is you still need protein, you know, there's still protein turnover going on. And like the amount of kind of things that its function will do within the body is like, you know, the list was just a short list. It was a simplified list, but there was like, you know, we're looking at like structural and enzyme and hormonal and all of that sort of
jazz. Yeah, that sort of stuck out to me too. I'm glad you brought that up, because that was another thing that, you know, coming from that bodybuilding sort of mindset, you just think, oh well, it's all about skeletal muscle, and that's mainly what you need protein for. But there's so much more that's not even directly muscle related. So,
yeah, I mean, it was quite an easy quiz as well. I enjoyed the quiz associated, you know, I read the words correctly, because that's usually what gets me not reading things. Bloody type 1 diabetes last week.
Yeah. But, you know, one of the other things that brought up kind of along those with the endurance part was the stuff that we learned in relation to elderly people and the protein needs. And I'd heard some stuff about that from Danny Lennon's podcast before. So it wasn't brand new to me, but it was really good to emphasize that. And that when you, as you get older, a lot of people, I think in their mind, they'd think, oh, you don't need as much food because you're getting older, you're slowing down, this kind of thing. And really they need more. So as we age, we actually need more protein because of that, that sarcopenia, which is the loss of the muscle, and that you're actually becoming more anabolic resistant to the resistance training and the amino acids from the protein. And so I thought that was really interesting. That
people assume like it's an increase in muscle protein breakdown and a decrease of muscle protein synthesis that leads to this kind of loss in muscle mass, which is, you know, sarcopenia being the kind of clinical term, where it is that, like, kind of they still have that basal response. It's just the stimulation, the response is kind of blunted to a certain degree. So they just need, I think the key one is, and even, oh, it was nice to have Billy presenting, you know. Which, shout out to Billy. We're getting a bit bored of Martin, let's be honest. You know, it's like, oh God, it's him again. But, you know, like, but like he even said himself, and I've heard Professor Stu Phillips, who's like one of the leading protein kind of researchers, talk about how resistance training's the most powerful stimulator of not only building muscle, but retaining muscle. And I think there's that, it's probably a difficult thing to approach with an elderly client to resistance train, because maybe they all assume that they're going to be doing, you know, 6-day splits or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, so how would you approach that with an elderly client?
Well, I mean, pointing out that even just a couple of workouts a week is really going to help them maintain it. You know, building muscle definitely takes a more structured approach. And I've heard Mike Israetel talk about that. And when you hear him talk about what you need to build versus what you need to maintain, it's significantly less effort to maintain what you have than it is to build more. And so, you know, with an elderly person, they really don't need to do a lot to maintain. Now, improving strength would take a little bit more work, but you know, somebody maybe who was getting older and they'd been active and they just were wanting to slow that process, they can do that with increasing their protein intake and then continuing with that resistance training.
You know, and it doesn't have to be like squatting and deadlifts, you know, like leg extension, leg curls, you know, chest press, all these fixed machines that just put a little bit of resistance through the muscles is going to be beneficial hugely.
Yeah. But I tell you what, I've seen some older women in their 60s, even 70s, learning to deadlift, and boy, they feel like powerful badasses when they're able to deadlift and do these kinds of things. And so, certainly worth encouraging that in some people if they're able to.
Well, I imagine that they'd naturally just go that direction. They might be just doing the chest press and the leg extension. They'll look at someone deadlifting like, you know, I'll give that a go. And, you know, before they know it, they're doing these kind of masters meets and powerlifting, you know, and like it's just an organic evolution, I suppose, of where they start from. But yeah, like the elderly, that's something that I really kind of like, really, I've for some reason, 3-4, like 60 plus year old women have just kind of crossed our door, and it's kind of like, ooh, this is new.
Yeah, it's cool. I love working with older people. When I was a physical therapy tech, basically I was a trainer coach. Essentially, the physical therapist would create the program, treatment program, and I would administer and coach the the people along there, but I worked with a lot of elderly people, people right after surgery. And for one, they're a lot of fun to work with too. I love just talking with older people.
I think a lot of them, you know, like the younger ones, the younger people tend to be mm-hmm. very vanity driven, where these people are kind of like, yeah, I'm not bothered. I just want to get healthy, yeah. you know, and like they've kind of been there, done that. Yep. So they're quite open to change. Some of them are, you know, some of them are very difficult, you know, they've got a lot of years behind them. So, you know, it's kind yeah. of hard to change that sort of thing. But, you know, that's something that you have to individualize for. And at the same time, you know, have to have that conversation with people, mm-hmm. Confront them sometimes and just say, listen, yeah. what are your aims, what's going on here, you know, what we're trying to do here, because some are still resistant to change, yet they're sat in front of you still.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, let's have a little look at some other protein sort of thing. You know what was quite a good thing? This whole deamination of protein. I was quite like chuffed mm-hmm. with myself when I kind of grasped that sort of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting that how protein can be utilized for other, you know, other energy sources, how it's broken down, those kinds of things.
And I think this is why, like, you know, the ketogenic diet, if it's too high in protein, it's no mm-hmm. longer ketogenic, because as much as they'll argue, the glucose is the preferred source of fuel for the brain.
Right.
You know, and the fact that you have to basically eliminate pretty much two macronutrients from your diet to get, you know, fuel from ketones doesn't tell me it's a kind of like a superior dietary technique.
Yeah, certainly won't work for me. I love carbs too much. I'd be hard pressed to stay that way for even a week, much less long term. But
I mean, what is it? I mean, we're going off topic here, but what is it with the ketogenic kind of zealots that fight it as if we're going against their religion? I mean, I don't know if you've experienced it much.
Oh yeah, yeah. I think some of it is it just. For somebody who's desperately trying to find something, it just sounds good to them. And it's like, oh, this is all I have to do. And then the fat will just melt off. I see that on magazines all the time. You know, keto this, and the fat will just melt away. And it's like, well, if the bulk of what you're eating is fat, I know if that was me, there's only so much fat I could stomach. So, but then there's other people who can overeat fat. And then so it doesn't work for everyone. I also think it's interesting how people, I kind of notice this trend. People are like all keto this, keto that. They're all on board. They're posting pictures. And then suddenly it stops. And I can't help but wonder, I haven't asked these people, but they're people I know well enough that I know what happened. They were keto gung-ho for a month. And then it just couldn't take it anymore. And so while they're doing it successfully, you know, whenever we're doing something successfully and we're excited about it and we're doing it right, then we're, you know, we're shouting it from the rooftops. But then once we realize it's not working for us, we're not sticking to it anymore. It's sort of like, I'm not going to say anything anymore.
Yeah, and I think, what is it? It's like, you know, 2 to 4 weeks to get into ketosis. Like not touching a carbohydrate, and then as soon as you take yourself out of ketosis, you've got to go through that entire process again.
Yeah, you eat a piece of cake at a birthday party and start it over again. Yeah. So
my favorite ketogenic people are the ones who identify as ketogenic in their like Instagram profiles. Like anybody who identifies as their diet in their Instagram profiles, I think needs to, you know, take a look in the mirror, basically.
Yeah, and you know, for some people it's worked out really well. I do know people who've been on it for multiple years. They love it. It fits their lifestyle well, their food preferences. They're healthy. They've lost 100, 200 pounds. Hey, great. That's awesome. But to promote it as like the savior of the world is just a bit, yeah.
Yeah, that's why I love Lane Norton. You know, like
as a care.
Did you catch him on Joe Rogan?
I haven't listened to it yet. I've been intending to. I just hadn't had a chance to get over and listen to it yet.
You can even hear on that podcast that the Joe and I think it was, I can't remember the other guy who are like, they seem to not like carbohydrates. They seem to have a bias there, Jeff.
Right.
they're kind of trying to like, still the words they use, the language around carbohydrates, even trying to get Lane to trip up sometimes, you know, and these people seemingly just have it in for carbs. And next week's carbohydrates. So, I'm sure there's going to be some myths surrounding that I can talk about with next week's guest, who I haven't got yet. So if you want to message us, do that. I mean, protein, we're talking about myths surrounding proteins, and that could be something. Before we go on to myths, like, let's talk about some recommendations for actual protein intakes, because if any of my clients are listening, this will be nice for them to hear. So what did you take away from like recommendations, Jeff? I know you touched on them briefly before.
Well, we had those recommendations of kind of really 1.2 to probably 1.7 for the average everyday person would probably be a good range to shoot for. But then there's this whole aspect of satiety with protein. And so really, you know, I've heard a number of other people talk, and I think this is a good thing also. And this is something I sort of recommend too for people, is go higher than that if you can. Some people struggle to just get those minimums, and that's fine. But if you can go higher, it can really help with satiety over the course of the day, because, you know, like at times if I'm trying to drop a few pounds and so I'm eating a lot less, usually if I'm not tracking, what I'll do is I eat breakfast and then I won't eat again till dinner. So I sort of do this sort of twisted kind of intermittent fasting type thing because I have to eat in the morning, so I can't skip breakfast. But what I'll do is I won't eat anything between 10 a.m. and 6 or 7 p.m., with the exception of a protein shake if I need it. So that protein shake in the middle of the day will tide me over because of the satiating aspects of protein. And so I think a lot of times erring on the side of more can be helpful from a practical sense. Even if you don't need it, it can really help with sticking to a calorie deficit.
And them figures Jeff gave us were grams per kilo per day.
Yes.
How are you getting on with the conversions? And Jeff,
I'm getting a lot better with it because everything in the course is all done assuming kilos and that kind of thing, and so I'm doing pretty well with kind of quickly on the fly.
And what about that S instead of Z in certain words, such like minimal, so something, you know, I've given out some examples, but
I missed myself and had my spell checker correct me, and I'm thinking, what's wrong with that? To use spellings for things.
But I'm exactly the same as you. Like, I think I used to be a little bit harsh on myself. If I was like, I would be aiming for about 2 grams per kilo. And if I was over, you know, if it was like 2.1, you know, you'd be like, oh my God, that's just idiotic and things like that, where it's like, hey, relax, you know, like, it's probably a good thing. Like, I love protein. And I'm like you, I'll do like protein modified fasts where the first meal of the day might be, for me, I don't mind having just a protein shake for breakfast and just cracking on with the day, especially having a young son. It just, it's busy. So it's easy for me to kind of just have that, smash that and get on with my life.
Yeah.
So I think the key point with anybody's diet is kind of just know your personal preferences. Jeff can't go without breakfast. Me, I can give or take it.
Yeah.
But like any time between meals is a fast anyway. You just kind of stick a protein shake, which might as well be 300 mils of water.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I think it's important too to understand those ranges and those, because there's no, I think that's where in the past I've had it wrong, where I've said, oh, you need to have this exact amount. But these are ranges. So like me, I've actually come to the point now where I weigh, right now I'm at about 188 pounds. And so, you know, in conversion to kilos, let's say 1 gram of protein per pound of body weight. So that'd be 188 grams or or so. But usually my protein intake varies probably from 150 to 180 a day. And now I'm perfectly fine with that because I'm well within the range of acceptable for the level of activity that I'm doing. And so I think that's an important thing people can take from the numbers, is that these are recommendations based on average response in people through a bunch of clinical trials. So you have the low end, the high end, and everybody in the middle. And so we really don't have to say, well, it's this exact amount. And if you eat more, then that's a problem. If you eat less, it's a problem. It's really a range that's going to be effective for what you're doing.
Yeah. And I tend to, with my clients, give them a range as opposed to a definitive number. I'm like, right. You know, if I give them a definitive number, I'll say within 10 either side or something like that. You know, it's just... It's not really a sort of, especially the fat loss ones, I try and give them as much flexibility as I can. So it tends to be a protein and calorie target. I try and minimize the risk of failure as much as I can with the majority of them. And by the way, Jeff said he was 188 pounds. That's 85 kilos in English.
Yeah.
But I'm the exact same. Just try and like kind of simplify it so just people can't go wrong. Because I think the general population typically are very black and white. And I think as coaches, we're trying to kind of get them to stay within that gray range as best we can, really.
Yeah, I think that can be really helpful when people have that freedom to know, hey, my fat intake can be anywhere from 50 to 100 as long as I adjust my carbs to account for the total calories, and you're fine. So you have this freedom to say, oh, well, I don't have to eat low fat, like super, super low fat or super, super low carb. I can fluctuate and I don't have to do the same thing every day. My protein can bounce around, my fat, my carbs, and I can still lose weight at just as effectively.
And this, and I think like I'm a big component of having flexibility within your nutrition. You know, it's been termed as flexible dieting, but like it makes it sound like a diet, you know.
Right.
But having the ability, and I think the word freedom is like such an important word when it comes to nutrition and training, because like yourself, I had a bit of a bias. If I skipped a workout, what was the point? You know, if I messed up, if I messed up a meal, what was the point?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, right, yeah, it's not as black and white as that. Again, you're being an idiot if like, you know, you skipping a workout like brings everything down, crashing down, you know.
Right.
But yeah, I think that's good. A good word, freedom. I like that. Right, so some myths surrounding protein. Any that stuck out for you, Jeff?
I'd say the biggest one is probably the kidney-related one. That's the one you hear the most, that too much protein damages your kidneys. And so, you know, if you're drinking whey protein shakes, that's going to damage your kidneys and that kind of thing. And just knowing that there's plenty of studies. I mean, this is pretty well settled now. You know, we say that science doesn't prove anything, but this is pretty well established, as close as you can get to proving something, that this just doesn't happen in healthy individuals. You know, obviously if somebody has kidney problems, putting the additional stress of high protein can cause a problem. But in healthy individuals, you know, you have the Jose Antonio studies, you have and some others as well, where they just and the Jose Antonio one, I think it was 2.5 to 3.3 grams per kilogram for a year. So these are pretty high levels of protein intake and in these resistance trained individuals, and they didn't see any noticeable change in kidney function or anything like that. And so I think that's probably the biggest myth that stuck out to me.
The biggest myth that stuck out to me was, because I'd never heard it, some people say that broccoli has more protein than steak. I'm like, who the fuck says that? I mean, I've never heard that. I mean, have you heard that?
I unfortunately have a number of people in my Facebook friends list who are caught up in some of those myths. You know, pomegranates will cure 5 forms of cancer, and drink apple cider vinegar and it'll make you grow wings and be able to fly, you know, all kinds of these crazy things. But that's one I've seen too, and I basically dismissed it without even looking at it. But it was kind of interesting in our M&U lecture this last week that they broke it down and said you'd have to eat like an insane amount of
It was nearly 800 grams to get 20 grams of, I mean, I don't know if you've ever seen 800 grams of broccoli.
I think only at the grocery store, and that's probably what they have in the bin there. It's 800 grams. But
I mean, this is a good little thing to kind of talk about, is complete versus incomplete proteins, because obviously there might be vegans or vegetarians listening. Do you want to go on a little bit about that, Jeff?
Yeah, that was another interesting thing that had been pointed out, and that there are only a few plant sources that have complete proteins. And, you know, quinoa was one of them.
Quinoa.
Quinoa. Yeah, and I think soy was one of the other ones. It's a complete protein. But in the case, let's say, for example, that broccoli did, in fact, have a reasonable level of protein that was higher than beef, it's not a complete protein. So you still are missing something from it anyway. And so that's an important thing. So if you're vegan especially vegan, because they won't supplement with anything else that's animal based, then they have to really be aware to make sure that they're getting that. The leucine seems to be the key component that's missing from a lot of plant sources.
Yeah, so what we mean by non-complete and complete, complete generally is in all animal and whey protein sources. Non-complete are typically missing at least one essential amino acid, where there's 9. And I think I liked, because, you know, there was 11 non-essential, but there was still some conditionally essential amino acids, such as like glutamine for burns victims and things like that.
Yeah, that was interesting too. I knew that there were essential and non-essential, but then that sometimes the non-essential are actually essential. That was kind of interesting, or just kind of a nice tidbit.
Yeah, and I was enjoying I don't enjoy this, but like the kind of fluid retention within the typically protein-starved Africans, you know, I can't remember what the actual condition's called, but they tend to have a bloated stomach. I literally repeated the condition about 50 times in my head so I could try and, like, you know, at a dinner party, like, you know, bring it up for no apparent reason to impress people. Yeah. But, that condition's known as such and such, but that's generally due to a protein malnourishment.
Right. And that's where it falls below those recommended guidelines of like 0.6 grams per kilogram, I think, which is super, super low. But that's kind of where those government guidelines fall in. It's to keep you from having that condition. But we really need more, which is what we talked about earlier. So.
Yeah, if we're going towards optimal health, that's what we're kind of want to do. And, you know, with considerations of proteins, we've got to look at the kind of protein to calorie ratio, especially for those that are dieting. Whey protein's probably one of them that's just kind of, you know, I think from a calorie, protein, quality, protein quantity, and affordability standpoint is my go-to with a lot of people, including myself.
Yeah. Oh, I think my protein shake that I drink is about 75 cents for 30 grams when you break it down to how much it costs. So I can get the equivalent of an entire chicken breast for 75 cents. I can't get meat for that cheap. So it's a really good bang for the buck, the whey protein.
And the shelf life of it as well, of course. You know, so like you can take it anywhere. We've got things like, I don't know if you've got them, they're like power towers. I'll show Jeff on the webcam. But it's like, you know, a tower where you put all your dry proteins in, and, you know, I'd stick them in my bag so I'm never caught with my pants down. And that's the bro bodybuilder in me wanting to spike muscle protein synthesis like 4 times per day. And there's another myth in itself. You'll only absorb 20 to 30 grams of protein. That was one that I'd like.
Yeah, I forgot about that one. That's another one. You hear it over and over. And you hear it from trainers. You hear it from trainers and people who they should know better. but it's still going around.
I was one of them trainers, you know.
I was too.
But yeah, it all gets digested and absorbed. But it's seen as like, you know, that 20 to 30 grams is what spikes muscle protein right. synthesis. So the rest doesn't get pissed out, I suppose. That's what people...
Yeah, there is value in trying to spread it out more, because then you're going to optimize your muscle protein synthesis better rather than eating 120 grams in one meal, spreading it out over the course of the day. You're going to benefit from it. Whereas if you eat it all in one meal, then you don't get the full benefit, but you're still going to absorb it.
Yeah, and I think I can't remember where I'd heard it, but like having protein too often, you know, like sipping BCAAs, which are a waste of money, by the way, between like meals, can make it can interfere with the absorption of protein. I can't remember the word. It's like refraction or something like that. I've heard it on Danny Lennon's podcast before, but you know, it's certainly not beneficial, and it's more beneficial to spread them out evenly across the day.
Yeah, well, there's a cycle of muscle protein synthesis. It can't occur constantly unless you're on drugs. But so it has, I think, this like 3 to 4 hour cycle. So you spike it, and then if you keep ingesting protein,
yeah,
it spike again. So you allow it to sort of drop off. And I may be wrong in the way I'm explaining it, but that was the gist of the way that I've understood it, is that the way the cycle of your body works is that you need this downtime, and then the large bolus of protein at a specific time to then spike it again. But of course, you have to have the resistance training aspect in there too to help with that. So a lot of factors, but
yeah,
really interesting stuff.
Yeah, I think like we touched on BCAAs there, you know, like that they're essentially a waste of money. I'll tell people to go buy some sugar-free Ribena or something, or like soft drink, I guess. Mm-hmm. Do they have Ribena in America?
I don't know what that is.
Ribena's like a blackcurrant soft drink, you know, diluted. Oh, okay. Yeah, you mix it. Get some Ribena in you, Jeff.
Yeah,
thank
I'll
me
have
later.
To see if I can find that. It's,
well, if you come over for graduation, we'll have some Ribenas and vodkas.
Well, I will definitely be over there. So.
Brilliant. Another thing, whey protein, because convincing people, you know, not only that protein doesn't give you kidney issues, convincing people whey protein isn't just for bodybuilders. And it's not a supplement, it's a food.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a good point in the lecture too that he pointed out, was the way that that cheese and whey are made. Cheese is basically casein taken out and coagulated, and then you have your whey, which is the other type of protein, and it's Billy was making the point that if whey is a supplement, so is cheese.
Yeah,
and I think that's a good point. And I think it's a good point. I think sometimes people don't think critically about things that they hear, because you wouldn't say an apple is a supplement when you take the peel off. Just because you take something away from it doesn't turn it into this supplement or turn it into some horrible processed food. Just because you break something apart into constituent parts doesn't mean that it's suddenly a bad thing. Now, there's value in having the whole food, but there can also be value in certain circumstances and just ingesting a part of that food at a time. So I think that's an important distinction that sometimes gets lost when people just aren't thinking critically.
Yeah, I think, this course is teaching many people to think critically, and I think it's quite good that, you know, I've had an experience, and as you have, of a lot of shit, so you've been able to kind of filter a lot of stuff out, and, you know, you've been within the evidence-based crowd in the background mm-hmm. there for a few years, possibly, so you've been, like, listening to people like Martin and other critical thinkers, you kind of pick up on these traits. I think we've pretty much covered protein. Anything you want to add about protein?
I can't think of anything.
Not
without just going over the entire lecture, which is probably a bit much for a short podcast.
Yeah, we're just going to play the lecture right now. We'll see you in an hour. Jeff, I've really enjoyed today. Is there anywhere people can find you and look at your stuff?
Yeah, I've really enjoyed this too. You can find me on Instagram. That's kind of where I've been putting most of my stuff recently. And that's at Jeff Ash Fitness, JeffAsh Fitness, all one word. And then I'm also on Facebook, and I usually post most of the same content, sometimes a little bit different. I might share articles there, and that's going to be at Hope Drives Me Nutrition, and on Facebook, and that's the name of the coaching company that I'm starting up. And so that's probably the two best places to find.
And I will link all of these into the kind of show notes, so you can find them all there. But I mean, I want to just say thank you, Jeff, and like, your story's unreal, and I think a lot of people will take away a lot of great kind of like understanding who Jeff is. And I think this is what I like again about the podcast, is we really get to kind of know the people who are doing the course with us. So I can imagine graduation, we all meet up and kind of know each other to a certain degree, like, oh, there's Jeff, how are you doing, you know? I can't wait, like, get Jeff a Ribena. You're gonna be you're gonna be full of chemicals in next November, fun. Jeff. Thank you very much, Jeff, and I'll again link everything in and speak to you down the line.
Sounds great. Thank you.